kwakuwamkwamnyako nauvuku na undukufu hata milele.
Broadcasting from high above the reserve, this is Radio Harambe. Jambo, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to Radio Harambe, the companion podcast to our website, jamboeveryone.com. I am Dave McBride, broadcasting from the Radio Harambe studios, and joining me from somewhere in the world, it's Safari Mike. Mike, how are you, and where are you today?
Jumbo Dave, I am sitting in a Jeep at in Bale Mountains National Park.
Bale?
Bale.
That's in Ethiopia.
How did you know that?
I'm a genius, Mike. Are you enjoying the food there?
I am indeed. You know how I enjoy Ethiopian food? Of course, they just call it food here. But yes, I do very much love the spongy bread and the various globs of meat. Quite good.
That's not a very tasty sounding description.
It doesn't sound good.
Spongy bread and globs of meat
is quite delicious.
And what are you studying there?
We're studying the lesser kudu, Dave. They have greater kudu at Disney's Animal Kingdom, but we are here studying the lesser kudu. I have a herd of them right in front of me. They're all females. A couple of unusual things about the lesser kudu. Number one is they don't really have they're not very territorial. So unlike many other antelope, that have specific territories, they just sort of meander around in a herd. The males are kind of solitary, beautiful spiral-horned animals, the males. And also, they don't really have a breeding season, which, of course, is unusual in the antelope world here in Africa.
Yeah, that is unusual. Now, the greater kudu they have at the lodge as well, correct?
I believe that is correct, yes.
Yeah, I always forget which one's where. But
they had them on the safari. But,
yeah, they did. Yeah.
Anyway.
Cool. So on today's show, Mike and I are going to discuss all the news from Disney's Animal Kingdom and the rest of Walt Disney World. And then in our final segment, we're going to talk to Dr. Rodney Jackson and Dr. Quentin Martins of the Snow Leopard Conservancy about the work they do and about a new documentary film starring Joe Rohde called The Leopard in the Land. We'll have more on that in just a bit. But let's start with the local news.
I'm very excited to talk to Dr. Jackson. One of the first books I read about conservation was his and his wife's book.
Called The Vanishing Tracks or something like
that,
right? Yes,
it was written in the late 80s, right before I started working at the Bronx. It was it's a terrific book.
Yeah, stay tuned for that. Mike, I'm sure we'll talk to Dr. Jackson about that in the interview there. So let's start off with the local news, as I said, and we're going to talk about Starbucks. Some concept art released for the Starbucks location coming to the former Creature Comforts gift shop on Discovery Island. Just want to sort of, give some full disclosure for anybody who's new to the show. I am not a fan of Starbucks as an idea. I'm not a fan of this specific rendering either, but I don't like Starbucks in the Disney parks at all. But with that aside, I don't like this on purely aesthetic reasons. You can go to the Disney Parks blog, and they actually have it there from sometime last week, and see it. You can also go to jamboeveryone.com, and you can see it there as well. The interior matches kind of the color scheme of the newly painted exterior, which kind of goes away from that sort of whimsical, vibrant Caribbean colors to more of a earth tone. And to me, Mike, it looks like it belongs kind of in the Jumbo House more than it does on Discovery Island.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about this last time about the outside. I'm not a big fan of the change in the color pattern. I do prefer that, that kind of unique, very colorful, like you said, vibrant pattern. This does match it. It's very African looking. looks more like it belongs in Harambe or, like you said, Animal Kingdom Lodge. Yeah. I am not, however, anti-Starbucks like you are. I have no issue with Starbucks coming into Animal Kingdom or any of the other parks. In fact, they've done a nice job in Epcot and apparently in Hollywood Studios as well. I do have a little bit of a problem them removing the Main Street Bakery for Starbucks. I think they took something away for it. But as long as they're not really taking anything away, and Creature Comforts is not taking anything away, I really don't have a problem with it. Although apparently these kudu like Starbucks. Every time I say the word Starbucks, they perk up. So if they start running off, Dave, I'm going to have to start barreling after them in my Jeep.
No problem. Not to repeat myself or get into this too much, my whole feeling kind of is, you know, you come into a new world. You come into, you know, you leave your world behind and come into this new one that is Discovery Island, this sort of imaginary world that you want to immerse yourself into. I just don't think that in this... with the storylines they come up with about things such as Discovery Island, that a Starbucks location is really something we would find in such a place. And I prefer I prefer when they're a little more creative and put some time and effort into matching the area with a certain sort of product to deliver. And grande mocha latte skimmed whatever doesn't really fit in the idea of Discovery Island. That's my only issue with it.
Yes, but did a Finding Nemo T-shirt or Haunted Mansion Vinylmation fit into to that as well? I mean, what difference does that make?
Well, two wrongs don't make a right. Two wrongs don't make a right. So if you're gonna have something here, if you're gonna imagine something new, if you're gonna make a new destination, I would prefer in the times that we are now, where as opposed to the Walt era, where Walt actually needed the financial assistance during Disneyland of these other companies to come in and help with the construction and to provide these things, because Disney wasn't an expert in food and beverage and all that kind of stuff. That's not the case now. Disney certainly has the creative force, the culinary force, the people that they need to create something cool and new and something that's befitting of the area. That's my only thing. I don't want to get too bogged down in this, so I'm going to move right along to this other little part of it, which is a reader on our site, Mike, kind of put me into a panic about whether or not this...
Who's this?
Her name was Jessie James, and she put me into a panic over whether or not this aesthetic on the exterior of this Starbucks is the new... The coming new norm of Discovery Island. Are we moving to, as all these buildings are getting fixed, are we moving to something more kind of earth-tony? Because we know that now we have walls up around the Island Mercantile gift shop as well, basically putting almost all of Discovery Island's buildings behind walls.
I sure hope not. I mean, they've worked on Flame Tree Barbecue already. And it doesn't really look like that. Even the new coffee area kind of keeps with the previous aesthetic. So I'm not going to panic yet. I have no reason to believe they're going to change everything.
Good. We're continuing our construction here, we just wanted to make a quick mention that Daisy Duck, for those of you who are character meet and greeters out there, and I famously am not one, she will now greet guests on the pathway by the former Creature Comforts gift shop. She seems to be kind of moving around quite a bit. That's where she was, I think, around Christmas time. She went back to the boat dock land, the boat character. What is it called, Mike? The character landing.
Boat landing. Yeah, character landing.
On Discovery Island, and now she's over back to where she was during Christmas, which was over by, oddly enough, the Starbucks location.
Maybe she likes coffee. I don't know.
Apparently. But there is some good news. Well, let me give you another little bit of construction news here. The Jumbo House itself, it's not just at the Animal Kingdom. It's also over at the Animal Kingdom Lodge. It looks like some work is being done. By the time you hear this, it might have been finished already, but I'm only reporting it because I'm not sure of the timeline of it. Apparently, they're just redoing the floors in the main lobby. And the only thing that that I would say is, man, it would stink if it's the first time you ever went there and you get that. You know, because it's such an impressive entrance into the building to hear as they're polishing the floors.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm surprised they can't do that all in the middle of the night, but that's not what they do anymore. So
no, it's not. But this is just a temporary, you know, kind of little blip. So hopefully it'll be up. It'll be back to normal soon, hopefully.
Good news on the construction front is something that we were not really expecting, and I don't think either one of us was prepared for this, which was when they took the walls down from in front of the Tree of Life, where the old Cotton Top Tamarind exhibit was, they revealed some new root areas, new animal sculptures in the roots that we didn't even know were coming until they were kind of released or until the walls were taken away. We thought it was nothing more than some, than painting the construction on the Tree of Life is nothing more than some paint and some routine maintenance cleanup and things like that. But that's not what it was. They were all, well, I mean, it might have been what it was, but it was also this, as artists actually sculpted some new animals around there, and they look just beautiful.
Yeah, no, I love it. You know, we talked about this before, that this is going to be probably an area where they're going to have performances, perhaps by Viva Gaia, part of the Rivers of Light, and all that kind of blah, blah, blah. And they created space there, and the backdrop, instead of just the tree, are these beautiful new, you know, quote-unquote roots. It takes over where the tamarind was and, you know, where that sign for the Tree of Life Gardens was. I like it. I think it looks nice. I like the deer. I like the bison, the macaw. They did a very nice job of keeping with that look of the Tree of Life.
And they brought it right up to the pathway so you can...
Yeah, you could grab it.
Yeah, exactly. And makes for some great photographs.
Exactly.
I mean, really enhances that, so you're going to be getting some really neat pictures in your Disney, what do they call it, the photo pass. I'm sure there'll be somebody planted in front of that.
Well, there's somebody already there. I mean, they've always had somebody there to take pictures of, the Tree of Life there. So, yeah, there are people there.
It's going to be perfect area. The bison is just gorgeous. I mean, that's an amazing job on that.
I'm partial to the deer and the antlers.
Yeah, those are really cool.
That's the one I like.
And the macaw also looks like the macaw is more the antler. The deer Mike's talking about and the bison I'm talking about are a little bit of a departure from what's on the tree, because they're almost like full size faces of the, you know, full around, not just sort of silhouettes onto the tree. When you see them, you'll know what I mean. They look almost like more like sculptures of the animal's head or the face, rather than just sort of drawn into or sculpted into a tree root. The macaw is kind of more like the ones that you would, you know, you could see that macaw on the tree, practically. I mean, it looks like that kind of feel. I think there's a rabbit, too, or something like that there as well. But take a look at it. There's some interesting stuff. And again, go to johnboeveryone.com and you'll find it there. Mike, we have a very interesting use of phraseology for a new animal event at the Animal Kingdom. Spring Forward Day is a animal day on March 5th, which is, this is one of these that happens at Rafiki's Planet Watch, just sort of a nice tribute to certain species and certain types of animals. And on March 5th, which is when daylight savings time begins, we have a day for frogs and toads and other animals that leap. Get it? Spring forward. So what they tell us is Rafiki's Planet Watch on March 5th will have the opportunity to learn about, or guest visiting will have the opportunity to learn about various amphibians and participate in fun amphibian-related activities, hop on by to examine amphibian adaptations, try leaping like a frog, which I already do, listen to and identify frog calls, which Mike already does, and make toad abodes. And I've always wanted a toad abode. I'm not really quite sure what you can do with that, but you can make one of those for your backyard. So we always love these things, and I like talking about them. So
I thought you just called those swamps, but that's okay.
Exactly. Bogs.
Well, you know, toads and frogs, I like. You know, we've always complimented Disney with these little events to try to, you know, help create some awareness for certain issues with certain animals, whether it's, you know, rhinos or bats on Halloween or whatever. You know, toads and frogs are very important They're also very important indicators of when a habitat is going wrong. They are very easily affected by pollution. There are genetic mutations when waterways are polluted, et cetera, et cetera. So when the frogs and toads start to have trouble, pretty soon the rest of the habitat might be in trouble. So they're important species to keep tabs on and to, try to protect.
And often forgotten about, certainly.
Correct.
In that regard. Mike, we got some news today that you must be very excited about. That a new book called A Cooking Safari with Mickey is going to be released. It's written by Pam Brandon and the chefs at Disney's Animal Kingdom and Animal Kingdom Lodge. And it is described, and I quote, as a collection of recipes showcasing the flavorful cuisine of South Africa and India. And for those who don't know, Pam Brandon is a food writer for Disney, but she's also written some other non-Disney food-related books, and she's even written a few non-food-related Disney books of all sorts of stuff. So there, she, for those of you who have some of the cookbooks, I know there's holiday ones, there's the Chef Mickey ones.
Right.
She's probably the author.
Probably. So, I'm very much looking forward to this. I mean, I think the Animal Kingdom Lodge has the best set of restaurants in Disney for a resort. And, we've always raved about the Animal Kingdom food itself. So, although, I am no cook. I could barely make toast. I am fortunately married to somebody who knows her way around the kitchen.
Right.
And, hopefully there will be some spicy Durban-style chicken and, lettuce cups from Yak and Yeti coming soon to my table.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the if you go to the Disney Parks blog, they actually show you the picture of the cover. I believe it's available now. I'm not 100% sure, but I believe it is. But regardless, even in this, they also give you a recipe, and it is for that spicy Durban chicken, which is terrific. So get her working on that, Mike, please.
I don't know if it's quite... Is it available now?
I don't know.
All it says on the Disney Parks blog is, here's a sneak peek of the cookbook.
Yeah, it does. You're right. It does say... it says it debuts this spring. So we don't have an actual date yet, but it is
coming
soon.
Probably like April or something like that. Well, but be on the lookout. It should be coming soon. I'm assuming they'll sell it at the parks, obviously, as well as other places. But yes, this is a cookbook that... I will purchase as a gift for my wife, but really, it's really a gift for me.
I was trying to think today what else you would need to have in it, right? You'd have to have the zebra domes, right? That's probably the famous one.
You think they'll give away that recipe?
I doubt it, but that's the one thing everybody's going to ask for, right?
Sure. I mean, I think one of the comments on the Parks blog.
What he said?
Has
forget it.
Asked for that. No, it said. But the big question is, will we get a Zebra Domes recipe? I mean, there's a lot of things they could do. There's a lot of great Geeko stuff. They do like the dipping sauces from the bread service and
right. And
all that kind of stuff?
I hope so. I hope so. Anyway, our final news in the local news is regarding the film The Leopard in the Land, which we're going to talk about in our feature segment. But I wanted to mention it here in the news as well, because we now know that it is available on DVD, and you can get it. We said before that you can get it through the Snow Leopard Conservancy, which you can still do, but they've made it a lot easier. You can now get it straight through eBay. And if you go to eBay and just type in Leopard in the Land DVD, you're going to come up with it. It's $20. All the money goes to help the Snow Leopard Conservancy. It's about an hour-long documentary starring Joe Rohde, which we talked about before. Mike and I are not only going to talk to the Snow Leopard Conservancy's director and assistant director, Dr. Rodney Jackson, and Dr. Quentin Martin's coming up in right after the world news, but Mike and I also have plans to give you a much more in-depth review of this in a future show. So if you go to eBay and put in Leopard in the Land, you will find that DVD. And I'll just say this. Listen to Mike. Go out and buy it. They're very good. It's yes. It's really, really good. So,
spoiler alert: we love the film.
Yeah,
we'll talk about it more in depth, but you could rest assured that we'll there'll be a positive review.
Exactly, and that will do it for the local news. So let's take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to turn it over to Safari Mike for the world news.
Mickey to Rafiki, come in, Rafiki.
Hello, my friend.
How's everything look up ahead?
So many people.
That's swell. I hope they're ready for a wild adventure. Let's get this show on the road.
We're on our way, my friend. Our journey has begun.
If you are looking for the best information, news, and opinions on Disney's Animal Kingdom, the only website to visit is JomboEveryone.com. Besides keeping you up to date on everything going on at the park, you can also find attraction and dining reviews, in-depth information on conservation and wildlife, and even some terrific images of the Animal Kingdom and its cast of furry friends. JomboEveryone.com is the internet's only site devoted entirely to our favorite theme park, Disney's Animal Kingdom. Visit us today and have a wild time.
Come everyone, clap along now.
Welcome back to Radio Harambe. It is time now for the world news. And as always, with that is a parked in a Jeep Safari Mike. Mike, you are able to read your notes here today. You are able to drive and give this to us at the same time if needs be, correct?
That's a good question, Dave. I'm not sure. I don't use notes. I do this all off the top of my head.
I figured as much.
Which would explain a lot. I'm sure.
Explain a lot of the complaints I get on email.
Complaints from about the world news?
I'm joking. What do we got? What's going on in the world?
The only
news?
Complaints I've ever heard were your
here we go again. Here we go again. Go ahead. What's in the world,
Dave,
news?
We are going to head to Old Fantasyland as well as the Caribbean. But first, you said you notice how I said Caribbean.
I know, and it's not Caribbean. But go ahead.
Well, according to Len Testa, it is.
Well, Len Testa doesn't know how to speak Caribbean, but go ahead.
First, let's talk about Tomorrowland and the Magic Kingdom. The arcade is closing, or if it hasn't already by the time you heard this, closed permanently at the Tomorrowland right as you exit Space Mountain. Of course, many of you know once you exit Space Mountain, there's a store as well as an arcade. And while Disney has not confirmed this, many believe that it is because of a new law in Florida that prohibits essentially these areas where you can, you know, play video games and earn tickets to, and, you know, as you gather tickets, get prizes and things of that nature. Yeah, I guess it has to do something with gambling. It seems ridiculous to me.
I could only imagine, Mike. I could only imagine because you can't possibly see the you know, the legislative house of the Florida state government taking up such a law by itself. It had to have been some sort of minor change in a pre-existing gambling law.
This is a new law.
And it wasn't part of like a bigger gambling bill or something like that?
I do not believe it was, no.
Oh, my God. Well, it's your tax dollars at work, Floridians. So now you can't go and gain tickets and buy yourself a big stuffed Goofy with your tickets.
Right. And you can't, I don't think you could do those claw things anymore where you put like $5 in and try to get like
really?
Yeah, all those things have been wiped under the carpet. I don't know why. I really don't know why.
How ridiculous.
It doesn't really seem like gambling to me, but whatever.
Well, okay. What's next?
Dave, let's go to we're going to talk about Starbucks once again. Oh, there goes there goes the lesser kudu. Hold on one second. I might have to start up the Jeep. No, we're good. Okay. Anyway, so in Starbucks, as you are maybe not aware, as you go to different Starbucks across the country, you get a "You Are Here" mugs. So if you're in New York, you could buy a mug that has iconic figure, you know, iconic buildings of New York. Mm. Well, they did things in Disney. So if you go to the Magic Kingdom Starbucks, you can buy this really cool Starbucks mug with Cinderella's castle and whatnot, and you could do one in Epcot as well, but they pulled the one from Epcot because the color pattern was essentially purple and silver, and the monorail was purple. And for those of you who may remember, that was the one that was, or one of two that was involved in an accident that killed a young driver. So Disney, in an effort not to disrespect that that sad event, has pulled all of those mugs from the market.
Yeah. God, when I read this, I just felt so bad for the guy who designed this, because the mugs themselves, the monorail is not the only thing purple. It's not like they made a purple monorail.
Right.
They made a purple mug that they put a monorail in. That was
right.
The color scheme that they went with, and never thinking. So everything in the on the mug is purple or
purple
gray
or
silver. Yeah. So it's all one sort of kind of, you know, one aesthetic to it, one color to it. And all of a sudden, somebody must have noticed that the color was probably the wrong one to use. And I just feel sorry for somebody for not having to, not knowing to think about that. And honestly, Mike, I wouldn't have thought of that.
Me neither.
You know,
and I'm not sure. I never saw any type of outrage about it on any of the social media aspects. Just all of a sudden, there was an announcement they were pulling them. So I don't know. I don't know. Some, you know, authority there at Disney sort of, I guess, it dawned on them and they pulled it. So I don't know.
Right. Right. It's that stinks. I feel bad for the guy who designed that. But anyway, what's next?
Dave, for quite some time, there has been an empty building in Adventureland called the Adventureland Veranda that used to be a fast food eatery. Well, apparently, they have requested that it be an eatery again. They're apparently going to set it up so that the Adventureland Veranda will return as, I don't know what kind of eatery, fast food, sit down, I'm not sure. But Liberty Tree Tavern, which is on the other side of, you know, the building on the other side of it, is going down for 6 months. And the permits are not specifically saying what it's going to be. There's some rumor that the fact that Liberty Tree Tavern is going down for 6 months is because they're sharing kitchen space.
Right.
But, you know, there is, as capacity increases in Magic Kingdom, it would be nice to have another eatery. And apparently the Adventureland Veranda, which has not really been in service for at least 15 years, maybe more.
Since the 90s, I think closer to 20.
Yeah, it's going to come back as what? I'm not sure. There are rumors about a Jungle Cruise theme, a Pirates of the Caribbean theme, an Adventurers Club theme. I don't know, but apparently permits have been filed to make it operational once again.
I would love to see an Adventurers Club type thing.
Would be cool.
Yeah, but I have a feeling of those choices, you're going to have a Pirates theme, because there's going to be a new Pirates film coming out in the not-too-distant future. So there's always never losing a chance during the Iger years to cross-promote as much as humanly possible.
It's nowhere near Pirates, to be honest.
And that doesn't matter. Well, Mike, they have Frozen. I shouldn't mention this anymore. They if they feel they need to cross-promote the film, they're going to put it anywhere.
Yeah, but you already have a Pirates-themed eatery at Tortuga Tavern, right across from Pirates.
Mm-hmm.
If they're going to cross-promote, I would suspect that it would probably be, you're more likely to see one based on the upcoming princess movie, the Polynesian princess movie, Moana, and maybe have some of the, you know, some of the feel from that movie coming out. I think that's 2016. I mean, this will be open earlier than that, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was that.
Yeah, that's going to be earlier than the Pirates. Pirates is not scheduled until 2017, I think. So, could be right. But some way to cross promote, I'm sure. It won't be just an Adventurers Club type of thing. It's going to be something, because they just don't build things like that anymore. But at the risk of getting too snarky, what is next?
Dave, we might be getting a new entrance to Disney World. In the summer of 2015, the Richard Petty driving experience, which I know you're a big fan of, is closing. Two things might be coming from that. One is more parking space. As you know, Magic Kingdom is, increased capacity, including the new Fantasyland and whatnot.
Uh-huh.
Oftentimes, the parking lot has to close before the actual park is closed to new guests, whether that be in the busy Christmas season or the busy summer season. But closing the Richard Petty driving experience and adding more parking space would certainly be of benefit. But also in perhaps in the cards is a new entrance from the north that would come down by, you know, Disney's Grand Floridian and provide a new way to actually get into the resort complex itself.
So coming in from the north, I don't see how the Speedway would, I mean, I'm thinking coming in from the north, you're talking about coming in from behind, God, it's got so many waterways and stuff there. I mean, you must be talking about coming in by the cast member's lot, by,
well, part of
north
the problem,
of Bay Lake?
Part of the problem is with the new cast member, with the new Fantasyland, they're having an awful difficult time getting cast members in and out of that area behind there, which is where they, you know, where their parking is and,
right.
and a lot of that stuff.
Right.
Apparently, even, you know, during some of the peak times of the year, it requires police supervision up there to, you know, direct traffic and stuff. It gets pretty bad. So
yeah.
adding some, you know, new flow would be of great benefit.
Yeah, I wonder what that would connect to. I mean, I guess north of the park would be 429 is probably runs all the way up there. The Beltway, the Western Beltway goes all the way up to. There's 535 is probably up there too. Trying to remember where these all go, but there's so many lakes and stuff. You know,
there's a lot of new. Apparently, from what I understand, there's a lot of new housing developments
yes.
going on up there north. You know, off property, obviously.
Oh, there are. I mean, I have friends that live right there. I have a couple of friends that live right in that spot, and there are all these little golf courses and nature preserves and all this kind of stuff. That's you know that's right there, right on all these lakes that are there. So getting in that way, I mean, I think that the Beltway, the 429.
Mm-hmm.
You get within, you know, shooting distance, so to speak, of the back of the Grand Floridian. So, like, if you're coming up past the Speedway, right, you have mm-hmm. to go, you go, the what is that, World Drive or something like that?
Right.
You go up World Drive, and before you hit the Magic Kingdom, you hit the Seven Seas Drive that takes you around, like, just next to the Polynesian and the Grand Floridian and, mm-hmm. and those that are right there. Now, if you were to just look at that area and bang a left and go past the Seven Seas Lagoon, you know, passing it on your right, kind of in between the Speedway and the Seven Seas Lagoon, you can go straight out there. There's that golf course that's there, which is a Disney golf course. You keep going straight, you're going to end up right on 429. So they may be talking about coming in that way. I don't think there's a lot of development over there.
Right.
I don't know, but I haven't been there in a long, long time. But I know that I've driven up that way because, like I said, we have friends that live up there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that would make sense. I mean, you're going to need a lot of county help there because you're outside of Disney property.
Right.
So I don't know how they're going to do it. None of those roads there are big. You know, they're not, except for the Beltway, really.
Right.
So it's going to be interesting to see how that is and what that really means. You know, I always thought the Speedway was a strange thing to have there anyway, but, you know, who knows? Probably just going to be parking. Maybe it'll be the Star Wars park.
Maybe.
Anything else?
Sure. A couple more things, Dave. The Be Our Guest lunch, which is, of course, counter service.
Mm-hmm.
They've been testing in recent months for resort guests the ability to make actually a lunch reservation. Well, that is now going to be open to the public, and you can start making reservations as of February 25th.
Explain this is going to work for a counter service.
Right. So you make a reservation, and just like any other restaurant, you can make it up to 180 days in advance. And at that point in time, and you can make that either through the phone number, of course, or My Disney Experience app. And then you can also pre-order your meals using the app. So anytime between 30 days before your reservation up until 5 minutes before it, you can go on your app and say, you know, you want the chicken sandwich and or whatever, and it'll be ready waiting for you. If you choose not to do that, you could still there are basically computer terminals where you can go on and like kiosks that you can go on and make your reservation. But you can pre-order it and get there check in for your counter service, and they'll come and basically deliver it for you. They call it, I think it's fast casual or something along those lines.
Nice.
It's basically counter service without the counter. And this is going to be available for everybody, just like any other reservation. If you don't show up, it's $10 fee for each person that doesn't show up. But being perhaps one of the more popular restaurants, counter service restaurants in all of Disney World, this may help alleviate some of those big long lines.
So, Mike, what is the over-under on the percentage of accuracy from order on your app to delivery of food?
I have no idea. That's a good question. But we will see. It's an interesting idea. I know.
Definitely.
One of the things about the My Disney Experience, one of their thought processes was to be able to sort of pre-order your food. So even if you don't, even some of these other restaurants that don't have a counter service, that don't have the crazy busyness of Be Our Guest and require reservations, you may be able to, in the not too distant future, be able to go on your My Disney Experience app while you're walking around, let's say, Epcot.
Right.
And say, figuring you're going to be at Sunshine Seasons in about an hour, pre-order. You know, go on your app and say, you know, I'm going to have the teriyaki chicken, and this guy's going to have the turkey club sandwich, and et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And it'll be ready and waiting for you, which is an interesting idea.
Well, sure.
It'll be interesting to see how it works, but if it works, it could be good.
It's interesting to see if it works, not just how it works. If it works. I mean, that place
True.
Is crazy.
True.
I mean, especially lunchtime, that place got nuts. So, I mean, I just hope this isn't the future of Disney counter service. I hope this is the only one that this really applies to, because I don't want to be stuck making reservations for every meal I have.
Be Our Guest is unusual. Because it has, I mean, people are waiting for an hour to get counter service food. That doesn't happen anywhere else. I mean, it was so bad during the summer that they were passing out free water and fans, and they were, you know, people were like sitting out in the sun for an hour to get into this thing. It was turning into almost a health hazard to have this long line of people trying to get, they just weren't ready for it. So people were waiting out on that bridge, and, you know, obviously people who have been to Disney World know what I'm talking about. There's that bridge leading up to the restaurant, and people were just sitting out there in the baking sun.
Yep.
And this summer, and like I said, it was turning into a health hazard. So, you know, that's not true for any other counter service.
That's true. You're right about that.
At least right now. So, you know, hopefully that won't become the norm for counter service, but perhaps the part that will become the norm, or at least the possibility of being able to pre-order your meals and have it waiting for you when you get there.
I just heard what I thought was one of the lesser kudos drinking water, but then I found out that it was really my dog. One of my dogs. So do we have anything else?
Two more things, Dave.
Go ahead. Yeah.
We talked about the Peter Pan's flight queue.
Yes.
About how nice it looks. Well,
yeah.
The interactive elements have now apparently opened for everybody, and they're kind of cool.
They look great.
Yeah, you get to see Tinkerbell flying through the room. Items will move around as she comes by. You can use your shadow to interact with things in the room. And there's a shadow of Peter Pan bouncing around. And before you enter the ride, you will be sprinkled with pixie dust, which is essentially a lighting kind of special effect.
Right.
That makes it look like you're being sprinkled with pixie dust, just like the movie. They did a nice job.
Yeah, I think it looks fantastic. And we've said this before when news of this came out, there was no place that needed more work than the queue at Peter Pan. I mean, it was just a dreadful queue to have to sit on for a long time.
Awful. Maybe the worst in the park.
Yep. And this looks like they've, you know, not only added air conditioning, but also added some really cool aesthetic elements and interactive elements. I think they've done a great job. And honestly, I don't normally go on this ride because I don't like waiting on the line for it. And I usually have other things that I use my fast passes on, but I think I might try it now because this looks good enough to get me to want to see what it looks like. So I'm interested.
Yeah. Peter Pan's flight is if I don't make a fast pass for it, I'm rope dropping it or close
yes,
to it.
Yes. Yeah.
So once the park's been open for about an hour, you can forget it.
Forget it.
Peter Pan's flight.
Yeah, and I don't even want to wait more than maybe a half an hour on that queue because it was just such a bad one. But
yeah, it was terrible. But yeah, you know, this helps absolutely.
And what is our final one? Final
one
story?
More, Dave. Yeah. One more, Dave. We usually don't talk about the cruise line, but I'm going to today.
Let's do it.
Star Wars Days at Sea. I know you've seen this, and I know you're very excited about it. But
we're going right
in 2016. In early 2016, Disney, on the 7-night Western Caribbean itinerary with Disney Fantasy, will have, and those sailing dates, and I'll go give that to you real quick, January 9th and 23rd, February 6th and 20th, March 5 and 19, and April 2 and 16, mm-hmm, departing from Port Canaveral, you will be able to have a day at sea where it's all themed to Star Wars, which will include a deck party, meet and greets with Star Wars characters, Star Wars themed activities and food and beverage and merchandise, as well as screenings of the various Star Wars films and Star Wars Rebels, the new hit animated TV show.
To watch those films and the big screen in the middle of the ship, Mike, I think this is going to have to be our next Radio Harambe meetup.
What does that have to do with Radio Harambe?
Absolutely nothing, but I want to go on it anyway.
Well, you can go on it. You don't have to have a meetup.
We got to go. Come on, we got to go on this. This
looks cool.
It looks great.
It looks cool.
I would, let me do that. Let me say this. If we go on this, I will do character meet and greets. More than one.
Okay.
Yep. People are always trying to get me to do a character meet and greet. Here it is. I will do it.
Who's trying to get you to do character
meet and greet? I always get this because I always talk about how I never go to character meet and greets. I always get yelled at. I get all these, you have to go do this. You have to go that. You're no fun. You got to go, you know, stand in line for one of this. Oh, you would love it if you saw this character. No, no, no. But if I can go take a picture with Vader, I'm going. Or Boba Fett. Chewbacca. This is going to be great. We got to do it. This is exactly what I was hoping for when Disney bought Star Wars. This is exactly the kind of thing. I love this stuff.
It looks cool. Looks cool. I will give you that. Yes.
So you're going to go. Great. So we got. Well, I'll start making arrangements tomorrow. And that's it for the world news.
That's it, Dave.
All right. So we're going to take one more break, one final break. And when we come back, we are going to talk with Dr. Rodney Jackson and Dr. Quentin Martins of the Snow Leopard Conservancy about the work they do and about a new documentary starring Joe Rohde called The Leopard in the Land. We are coming back with that in just a second.
I'm Explorer Mickey, and like most kids, I love zebras, and some of the coolest are the Grevy Zebra. But if things don't change soon, there won't be any left in the wild. The Grevy Zebra Trust is doing everything they can to help keep them from extinction. But there are only a couple of thousand left, so we have to work fast. Go to their website, GrevyZebraTrust.org, and donate anything you can. Even a small donation will help keep the Grevy Zebra alive for us kids and the future generations to enjoy.
And welcome back to Radio Harambe. There are only a few thousand snow leopards left in the wild. Placing them on the list of endangered species, they suffer from shrinking habitat, loss of natural prey as a consequence. They're also hunted. Farmers and herders hunt them to protect their livestock or just to defend their livestock. But they're also hunted for other reasons as well. But there are some terrific people doing everything they can to help save these elusive and just gorgeous cats from extinction. The Snow Leopard Conservancy, along with Disney's very own Joe Rohde, the legendary designer of our beloved animal kingdom, have joined together to help the snow leopards. And joining us to discuss this partnership and the work they do, we have Dr. Rodney Jackson, the director of the Snow Leopard Conservancy, and Dr. Quentin Martins, who is the assistant director of the Snow Leopard Conservancy. Gentlemen, we are pleased and honored to have you.
Thank you, Dave. It's an honor to be here, too, for us.
Now, before— Thank you very much. Absolutely. Wonderful to be talking to you guys today.
Now, before we talk about Mr. Rohde's involvement with you guys and the film, which Mike and I have talked about so many times in the show ever since it was even announced, I want you guys to talk just a little bit about, let's start this way, about the Snow Leopard. You know, the dangers they face. I touched a little bit on it there. And also about what your organization is doing to help save them.
Okay, I guess I'll start. So snow leopards are a Central and South Asian species found really in the high mountains of Asia, all the way from the Himalayas in the south to southern Siberia, mountains of Russia, and the mountains of Mongolia in the north. It's a huge area, about the size of the western U.S., and we really don't know how many are left. The rough guess is somewhere between 3,500 to maybe 7,500 cats spread very thinly over this vast area. And we can talk later, if you want to talk now, about the threats. Shall I move into that?
Or? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, the main threat, I think, really emanates from humans. People in the area have been poaching the prey base of snow leopards, so the cat has no choice but to turn to domestic livestock. And, of course, livestock really is the bank account for most of the people that share the habitat with snow leopards. And the loss of even a few sheep and goats or yaks can be catastrophic to them. And so this sets up a vicious cycle in which snow leopards take the livestock, people then have to kill the predator.
And this is something that Mr. Rohde points to in the film as well, and talks pretty eloquently about. I know that there are some people that hunt the animals simply to hunt them for their fur as well. They're poached, so to speak. But the habitat loss is really the driving factor here, correct?
Well, it's more the conflicts with humans, the herder. The habitat is getting fragmented and broken up by roads and mining and people moving into areas that were previously sparsely inhabited by humans. It's a combination of factors, really, but at the base of everything are the local people who are eking out a subsistence livelihood in a very, very difficult environment.
So what we're trying to do at the Snow Leopard Conservancy is to work with communities, and you know, a large proportion of our biodiversity rests in the lands of private landowners and communities. So you know, considering that snow leopards have got such vast ranges, generally their ranges would overlap with these private landowners or communities in this case. And, you know, it's really, for us, it's important to work with these people. And we focus on different ways of looking at having them benefit from these activities, often looking at ways to mitigate conflict with these predators. So, for instance, we've implemented various methods such as corrals, specially designed corrals that would keep snow leopards out, protecting their livestock, as well as testing new methods. For instance, the use of fox lights are a new mitigating tool that we're testing out in the field at the moment.
And Mike, you have any questions before we get into the film?
Sure, absolutely. Dr. Jacks, I guess this question is mostly geared for you. When did you first start, you know, studying the snow leopard?
About 34 years ago, I guess it was. In the late 70s, I happened to travel to Nepal to a remote area and encountered this whole conflict between, you know, the local herders and snow leopards. And at that time, almost nothing was known about snow leopard. You could probably put it on a postage stamp. And being trained as a biologist, of course, I took up the challenge. to study it, and I was lucky enough to win the Rolex Award for Enterprise that provided the initial funding and enabled me to prove that it was, in fact, very feasible to put radio collars on such an elusive animal and track them and get vital information on their life history and habitat requirements, etc.
Have you seen any difference in the way snow leopards are maybe perceived, I guess is the best word, in locally since when you first started to now?
Yes, I think more people are aware that there is this beautiful cat out here, partly from visiting their local zoos, partly from the internet and the many sort of magazine articles or stories that you begin to hear. But this hasn't necessarily translated into more action on the ground. You know, these countries have limited budgets. Wildlife departments that are charged with looking after rare species are often based just in the towns, and it's very difficult for them to get into remote rural areas. And over the last two to five years, I think there's been an increasing awareness that we have to engage local communities, and in fact, they could become very effective stewards for snow leopard and indeed biodiversity conservation.
When did your book come out?
My wife, Diala Hillard, wrote the book Vanishing Tracks back in the late 80s, so it was published in 89. It is now available on Smashwords, so print editions are not available. And that book actually described our encounters with snow leopards over the 4.5 years that we studied them in the very remote mountains of western Nepal. Since that time, I've been working in many other of the 12 range countries, and the focus really has been on twofold. One, training park rangers and biologists on survey techniques. So how do you count such an elusive animal? Because you do need to know where the hot spots are, where the corridors are that connect the different populations so that you can implement effective conservation plans. And along that road, I really realized that, you know, it would take enormous resources to get park people to travel to such remote areas, and that if we could get the local herders, who really are the eyes on the ground, much more committed and to protecting the cat, often they don't even realize they've got this unique heritage right on their doorstep. And, you know, they are thinking of wearing blue jeans, and they want radios and cell phones and that kind of thing. Right. And yet they've got just this incredible resource. And I think, if I can be a little extended here, I think the real answers come from Ladakh, India, where we started to work with communities. And the first thing we did was to predator-proof their nighttime corrals so that snow leopards couldn't get in and kill their animals. That alleviated a lot of anger on their part immediately, but it didn't solve the problem, because the problem really is that they have a very tenuous livelihood. They're living on the edge, and what we really need to do is find ways of increasing their income. And this is where rural tourism got involved in it. And to cut a long story short, in the 7 years that we've been working in Ladakh, the local women in the villages have been running bed and breakfast operations. They earn something like $12 to $15 a night from visitors. And this has made a dramatic change, not only to their lives, because they can send their kids to good schools now, but also to the snow leopards. So no longer do they see it as a pest. They see it as an asset. They don't harass it. And just last year and the year before, I was in Ladakh, and I was lucky enough to see snow leopards 8 times in 10 days. You contrast that with my previous 30 years of work, where I would be lucky to see the cat once or twice a year. So this is really dramatic, and it really convinces me that we need to make snow leopards into really valued assets.
And Dr. Martins, I would ask this initial question Mike had to you, which is how you got involved with the snow leopard and your background with this particular animal.
So my interest has been, I started out working on mountain leopards in South Africa, and they say they suffer similar threats to snow leopards. And in fact, mountain leopards down there behave in very similar ways. It's just our mountains aren't as spectacular as the Himalayas, really. Mm-hmm. But they occur in low densities and also have the same sort of issues with persecution and habitat loss. But, you know, I've been looking at broader landscape conservation initiatives, using these apex predators as a way of drawing attention to broader environmental issues. So this is a really great opportunity to work on a fantastic foundation that Dr. Jackson set up with the Snow Leopard Conservancy, and work on a global level where we can look at highlighting these mountain ecosystems and how important they are to providing ecosystem services to communities. The Himalayas are a great example where snow leopards occur, where essentially one could look at water quality, community efforts that would improve livelihoods, mm-hmm. And that sort of thing. But that would affect communities further below, for instance. So ultimately, if we can find a way of saving snow leopards, we would need to look at broader environmental conservation and community upliftment.
Now let's talk a little bit about the film. It is an extraordinary film and an extraordinary advocate for the snow leopard. But before we get into sort of the film, I'm curious how Mr. Rohde got involved with the Snow Leopard Conservancy.
Yeah, maybe I'm best to answer that, because I got an email from Joe, it's probably going back 2 years now almost, expressing his interest in going to Mongolia and painting landscapes and using the funds from the sale of those paintings to benefit snow leopard conservation. And so I put him in touch with our partner over there, Dr. Mundsag, who is the country's designated big cat specialist and with whom we work for maybe 10 years now, and asked him to suggest a routing for Joe that would give him exposure to the different landscapes within the snow leopard range, as well as an opportunity to see a snow leopard. You know, Joe is incredible. I totally agree with you. But the strength of what he's done, I think, really, is he's opened the door to the role that artists and writers can play in conservation. And that revolves really around people's emotions, of highlighting the power of the animals, of the environment where they live, and bringing those values, those emotions, to play into getting support and understanding of conservation and the need for immediate action. So thank you, Joe.
I mean, he's been doing that for years. I mean,
very effectively, I can see that.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about the film. It opens with Joe Rohde up in what he thinks is, or what I guess what they kind of deduce is, an area where a snow leopard may in fact be living. He makes these comments about how, just the fact that he sees these tracks is such an extraordinary thing, and that he's sitting here sketching and he's thinking to himself, you know, I'm probably being watched by this leopard. And it makes me wonder, and even the opening vistas and where he is in these pictures, the natural camouflage that the snow leopard has, besides this gigantic and remote location, it makes me think the conservation effort for a cat like this has to be an enormous challenge. I mean, besides the fact that you can't find them and that they're in this huge habitat, I believe mm-hmm. you're calling me from California, which isn't exactly Mongolia as far as locale. I mean, the cost and the effort that must go into this seems Herculean just from the opening scenes of this film. Is that true?
Oh, it is. You know, when we first did our study, we had to walk for 12 days.
Wow.
Just to get to the study site. And that was after renting a private plane into a remote short airstrip. Things have improved. You know, there are roads into parts of China now, parts of Mongolia. So right. You can go by vehicle. You can happily go by camel. You can also go by foot. You know, it's like studying a ghost, really, because this cat has just such incredible camouflage. When I was in Nepal, I would walk sometimes less than 15, 20 feet away from a snow leopard and not see it. And realize it was there when there was suddenly a rustle behind me. I look and I saw a tail disappearing.
Wow. Mike, you have anything?
So these are big challenges, but, you know, yeah. I think in some ways not seeing your animal means you pay more attention to its details of how it lives. You start bringing in other senses. And Joe has done that very well, looking at tracks, just the ambience of those high passes near the rocky areas. We know snow leopards love rocky areas. We know they love to hide, just like a cat, and look at you and feel that you cannot see them.
In today's day and age of, you know, Animal Planet channels and all these documentaries, do you think the challenges of even photographing a wild snow leopard, let alone putting together a documentary, as opposed to like tigers or lions that are just, you know, all over TV, has that been a challenge in terms of trying to get awareness for the conservation issues and get money?
Well, I think that with most of these really elusive cats, and snow leopards probably being, you know, one of the most elusive of them, you know, we've had to resort to other techniques of highlighting these animals by getting tangible evidence of their existence. And, you know, the use of remote camera traps has been a fantastic way of doing that. And it's been a great research tool for people working on animals like snow leopards, tigers, jaguars, and mountain leopards. So that's been a great way to actually get, you know, tangible evidence that people could see them out in the wild. Mm-hmm. But actually filming these animals has been possible, but just takes so much time that a lot of these production companies and that just simply cannot afford to spend that amount of time in the field. But as Dr. Jackson mentioned earlier, you know, there are beginning with cases, for instance, like in Ladakh, where people are getting more and more sightings of them. You know, there have been these ad hoc incidents where people have been able to photograph or film snow leopards in the wild without being collared. And I think that, you know, with more work being done in this field where we involve communities, where snow leopards who are innately not that aggressive anyway, that they would become more accessible to photographers. And, you know, simply being the most gorgeous cat out there, I think it's an incredible opportunity to look forward to.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question about the local sort of spiritual importance of the snow leopard. He, in the film, Mr. Rohde talks to, I believe, a local herder who says something about, he was kind of captured by this quote where he said something, when the snow leopard left, the mountain lost its echo. He talks about sort of the snow leopard's place in sort of the spiritual world there. But it's difficult for us to understand, those of us who are not there, how that sort of coexists with this poaching, with this, destruction of these animals. I just kind of want to throw that out to you and speak to this sort of, you know, dichotomy between what seems to be a spiritual importance in the local community, but also this, this, you know, prevailing feeling of it being a pest for all these years.
Yeah, well, you know, one thing that is really happening is culturally these people are undergoing very, very rapid change, with westernization being such a prominent force in the area. And so traditional cultural values, stories, from grandparents to children aren't necessarily being carried on because they don't see the worth in it. They think that Western, you know, clothing and the quality of life is maybe a better way to go. And one of the things we're working on very hard is to encourage people to retain their culture. You know, once they lose their culture, their language, everything essential in their past history will be gone. So these people do see snow leopards as spiritual guardians of their sacred places, be it a mountain, be it a spring, or a particular river system. And they're beginning to realize now that when somebody comes and kills a snow leopard, that often catastrophic events happen to that family. And this is particularly the case in Mongolia, Russia, where, you know, following the breakup of the Soviet Union and that empire, people had no knowledge of how to raise money, how to feed their families. The easiest thing they could do, because they did have knowledge of where snow leopards were to go out and put out the traps that the Soviets had previously given them and sell the pelts or the bones to the big market, which right now is mostly in China.
Right.
And the families that have done that often have suffered some really tragic event. And now their communities are beginning to link the two together and saying, well, you suffered, your father died, or your aunt died, or your kids all died because you killed a snow leopard, and the spirits are getting back to you. So we certainly encourage, you know, people to maintain their values here and to recognize that there probably are spiritual forces out there beyond our knowledge and that, you know, may have an influence that we will learn about in future times.
Fascinating. Mike, I assume you're driving.
Yeah, why, you can hear me driving?
Yeah, because now it sounds like we're conducting this interview on the Atlantic City Expressway. So here's what I need you to do. Ask your last question, then press mute.
Actually, I don't really have a question. I just have, like, more of a comment.
Go ahead.
I still have a copy of the hardcover edition of Vanishing Tracks in my house. It's from 1989. I must have bought it in 1989. And it was very influential to me in terms of, you know, becoming interested in conservation and becoming a docent at the Bronx Zoo and trying to, you know, make people aware of situations. And so I just wanted to thank Dr. Jackson for that book, as well as his wife, Miss Hillard. You know, it's a terrific book. And if anybody out there gets a chance to read it, I highly recommend it.
Well, thank you. I just like to highlight that, you know, a lot of things have happened since the book was published in 89. And the Smashword version does include all the, you know, epilogues and prelogues that show how our journey over this time, and especially Darla being the primary author of this book, you know, just telling a story, given that, you know, she works very closely with me, we husband and wife, really, it's her writing, I think. I aspire to that kind of writing, and I hope one day I'll be able to do the same.
Now, I have just one kind of last question that I always ask people who work in conservation, because I'm always fascinated by those who don't understand why people do this. and it'll make sense when I give you this quote. At the end of the film, Joe says something to the effect of, actually, he says, "If we can't save this animal, the solitary, mysterious cat, what hope is there for tigers and elephants and rhinos that everybody wants a piece of? And ultimately, what hope is there for us?" And it seems to me that that spirit is what kind of drives conservation throughout the world. And I just wanted you guys to talk a little bit about why it is so important for us to save this cat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, there are many reasons. There are ecological reasons, because it is a top predator, and if you lose that, you can have imbalances and you can have a whole ecosystem going astray and opening itself to exotic species coming in. We all know that from, I guess, Florida. We've had a lot of invasive species. But right. I like to focus on more on the spiritual side. You know, snow leopards capture, to me, the essence of wilderness. And if we lose wilderness, we've really lost a vital part of what has been in the world for millions of years, and we can never get it back. Once it's lost, it's lost. So species like snow leopards, you know, like tiger too, that are in the lowlands surrounded by these dense populations of people, you know, they're emblems of wildness. We've got to keep that wildness.
Beautifully said. It seems to me that besides the thousands of dollars that Mr. Rohde raised here, but also the awareness and this amazing film, I would imagine this was a pretty successful endeavor on his part, wouldn't you say?
Oh, very. Because, you know, what it did to us, or to me anyway, it brought the power of artists and writers as a spokes group for conservation, as partners to conservation. Joe has raised about $40,000 that is going all to Mongolia to conservation there. And he's very graciously donated his paintings to us to even raise more money. So on our web, we have the paintings that Joe made through that whole incredible expedition at the beginning of winter with trying snowstorms and high passes to go over. And we welcome any of your guests to, you know, take a look at that. If there are paintings that they would like, well, we happily provide them to you in exchange for conservation support.
They are gorgeous. They are absolutely beautiful. And also, as far as the film goes, if people can go to the snowleopardconservancy.org, and then under the Make a Difference tab, there it says The Leopard in the Land, which is the name of the film. And I believe there they can now buy it directly off eBay, correct?
That's correct. You can buy the CD, the DVDs, yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, what else could people do to help the Conservancy do this?
Well, there's a number of things. One thing I'd like to mention, Quentin may have others, is just increase awareness about the threats that Asian wildlife and Asian ecosystems are facing, because we're on the other side of the world, and it just seems so remote from us. Mm-hmm. But these countries, you know, many of them are quite poor and just don't have the resources to protect, and that protection needs to happen now. We can't wait.
Dr. Martins?
So, I mean, we're also looking at, you know, broadening the awareness to any, including a local sort of component to contextualizing the project in America, and looking at mountain lions as a good example of where there's been a lot of work done, a lot of resources spent on these animals. And, you know, there's not a great deal of awareness, public awareness put out there regarding these animals.
And they could also, obviously, through your website, they can make donations. As you said, you can buy your book, Vanishing Tracks, is there. There's some other things as well. You know, all of it can be done right at the snowleopardconservancy.org. Gentlemen, I can't thank you enough for doing this. This has been absolutely fascinating and eye-opening for us. And also, I'm speak for Mike here as well. I can't thank you enough for the work that you do. I mean, saving the planet is going to be a different thing. Saving these animals are going to be a difficult thing, but at least there are people doing that, and I can't express our appreciation enough for that to you.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, thank you. It was a great pleasure, and thank you for all that you guys are doing to raise awareness for our wild animals.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for this opportunity. It's been great. Great talking to you. And, yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much. And thank you once again for tuning in to Radio Harambe. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes. Leave us a review. Those reviews really do help get the word out on the show. I'm not sure how, but they seem to anyway. At least that's what everybody tells me. Don't forget to check our website, jomboeveryone.com. There you're going to find everything you need to know about Disney's Animal Kingdom. While you're there, please check out our store, where we are selling some great unofficial Animal Kingdom merchandise. All of the profits of those goes to our conservation partners. We also remind you once again, snowleopardconservancy.org. There you can find a copy of the film. You can donate directly to the store or to the conservancy. You can make you can buy things at the store, the book, all of these things are all available right there, snowleopardconservancy.org. Also, feel free to follow us on Twitter. I'm at Radio Harambe. Mike is at Jombo Everyone. We're also on Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest, YouTube. Find all those links at jomboeveryone.com. So, for Dr. Quentin Martins and Dr. Rodney Jackson of the Snow Leopard Conservancy, and For Safari Mike, I'm Dave McBride. Kwaharini, go well, and thank you once again for listening to Radio Harambe. Cool.